So before Dr. Krishnachandra comes, let's take a look at the problem that we're removing today. The first surgery will be Avasura. This is number 7 on your handout. Avasura, the demon who assumed the form of a gigantic snake, represents a malignant, sinful mentality that desires to cause trouble and violence to others out of hatred and malice. This tendency, being one of the offenses to Harinam, must be killed by Krishna. Agasura, the personification of intolerance and cruelty, is the 7th obstacle. Due to a lack of compassion for the living entities, there is a possibility that one's attachment will gradually diminish, because compassion cannot remain separate from attachment. The basis of compassion for living entities and devotion to Krishna is the same, just like the two sides of a coin. So, I thought we'd start by looking at which mode of devotional service would be likely to indulge in such malice and violence. It's tamagun. And so I thought we'd look again. We've looked at this before in previous classes, but I thought we'd have another look at it. This is from Srimad Bhagavatam 3.29.8. And this time we'll read something from Prabhupada's purport as well. This is Kapiladev's teachings. And here he says, devotional service executed by a person who is envious, proud, violent, and angry, and who is a separatist, is considered to be in the mode of darkness. Prabhupada says a few interesting things in the final paragraph of this purport. One who approaches the Supreme Lord to render devotional service, but who is proud of his personality, envious of others, or vengeful, is in the mode of anger. He thinks that he is the best devotee. Devotional service executed in this way is not pure. It is mixed and it is of the lowest grade, tamasa. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur advises that a Vaishnava who is not of good character should be avoided. A Vaishnava is one who has taken the Supreme Personality of God as the ultimate goal of life. But if one is not pure and still has motives, then he is not a Vaishnava of the first order of good character. One may offer his respects to such a Vaishnava because he has accepted the Supreme Lord as the ultimate goal of life. But one should not keep company with a Vaishnava who is in the mode of ignorance. So this is a very interesting point that Prabhupada is making here. And why it's not a good idea to associate with such people will become very evident. That's from 329.8 purport, last paragraph purport. Okay, so Manusamhita tells us that there are three kinds of violence. And they're progressively harmful, and therefore, of course, the reaction is progressively more severe. First level is physical violence. Second level is mental or emotional violence. And the third level is spiritual violence, which means to break somebody's faith by your words, by your actions, like that. So, physical violence, mental or emotional violence, and spiritual. And of course, it's likely that more than one kind of violence will be happening at the same time. Quite often, if there's physical violence, there will be emotional distress, mental distress, so the two are going hand in hand. If it's a devotee that you're committing that violent acts against, then it's also maybe spiritual violence. May break their faith in Vaishnavism, in Prabhupada's process. So there are a couple of subtleties that I wanted to share with you at this point. Interesting little things. First thing is that violence in and of itself is not a bad thing. It's the motive. Are we malice in our intent? Or are we using violence for a good purpose? Prabhupada, in his analogies in the Bhagavad Gita, he gives the example of a surgeon, qualified surgeon. He's using a knife, Yeah, his purpose is to save the person's life, not to kill him. We also see with Battle of Kurukshetra, Duryodhan and Pati were very much in a mood of malice, but Arjuna and Yudhisthira weren't. They were fighting a dharmic war. So this is an important point to consider, what we're looking at here. A second thing that I find really fascinating is Prabhupada's how he defines ahimsa. This is from Bhagavad Gita. He's talking about qualities. Krishna is talking about the qualities of knowledge. And Prabhupada gives very revolutionary purports. This is from the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, verses 8 to 12. So when Prabhupada defines non-violence, he says, non-violence is generally taken to mean not killing or destroying the body. But actually, non-violence means not to put others into distress. People in general are trapped by ignorance in the material concept of life, and they perpetually suffer material pains. So unless one elevates people to spiritual knowledge, one is practicing violence. One should try his best to distribute real knowledge to the people so that they may become enlightened and leave this material entanglement. That is non-violence. So what he's basically saying here is if you're not preaching, you're committing violence. Interesting point. So Mahaprabhu, he didn't only cry in separation from Krishna. He also cried as a baby when people weren't chanting the holy name. So we can understand that it's Mahaprabhu's desire, and we're followers of Mahaprabhu, believe it or not, we're followers of Mahaprabhu. So our business should be distribution of the holy name and the culture of the holy name, which of course is based on Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. Because everybody is so proud of their homes, but anybody living in this material world is homeless. Home means go back home, go back to Krishna. Nothing to do with this place. So our business should be, you know, to help overcome Mahaprabhu's distress, the Acharya's distress. They're not happy to see everybody suffering. Because of our very low consciousness, we're not so concerned as long as it's not us that's suffering. But the tendency of the, you know, it's Paradukaduki, the Vaishnava. He doesn't like to see anyone suffering. He understands that everybody is part of Krishna's family and they belong to Krishna. So I found that very interesting. And then there's another one that Prabhupada's got such a way with stories. He tells us through this story that self-interest and lack of foresight can be an act of violence. So I'll read you this story. It's from Prabhupada Nectar. It's volume 5, story 40.
Self-interest and lack of foresight.
Self-interest and lack of foresight, yeah. Like not considering the consequences of what you say or do. Interesting little story. Prabhupada's in Mayapur in 1974, and he told two stories. I'm only going to read the first one. A boy was raised by his aunt, who treated him very liberally. Through bad association, the boy became a thief, yet the aunt encouraged him. Oh, it's a very good business. You're bringing so many things home without much labor. In time, the boy became a murderer. He was captured and sentenced to be hanged. When asked what was his last wish, the man said he wished to speak to his aunt. The aunt was crying and crying. When she leaned forward to hear what her nephew wanted her to hear, the man bit off her ear. He then rebuked his aunt, saying that if she had chastised him for being a thief, instead of showing him kind affection, he would not have been hanged, and she wouldn't be lamenting. So this is a very clear picture of how self-interest and lack of foresight can actually do very serious harm to a person. I thought, wow. So my first reaction when I read this story is, what a horrible person. You know, really. But then I thought, well, let's see if there's any of this in us. First thing I did when I was considering this was I thought, let me just do a little brainstorm. Just a 2-minute brainstorm. To think of examples of how violence, we see violence in ISKCON. There's no structure, it's just thoughts that came over 2 minutes. A lot of thoughts came. Forcing a child to chant, feeding in bogue, emphasizing rules and regulations rather than developing love for Krishna when teaching, preaching, or counseling. Not practicing what we preach, not preaching or teaching, advising or preaching above a devotee's level of adhikar.
Too fast.
Oh, this is just ideas.
Nice.
I'll show you later. Breaking our vows, committing offenses, propagating an understanding of devotional service that excludes shravanam kirtanam. This has done major. There's a major disruption in this movement. This one. Misrepresenting Srila Prabhupada and the Acharya's teachings and mood. Using Srila Prabhupada, Guru or Shastra for our own purposes. Hindering rather than helping Guru or Sadhu by burdening them with petty problems. Doing our entrusted service whimsically and not doing them at all. Doing them in a bad mood. You know, this is all violence. So I thought, well, let's just do a little reality check. This is very personalized. I don't want to embarrass myself or anybody else. But I want you to do this little exercise in a very introspective and very honest way. We're here for surgery. So what I'm going to do is ask you a question, and then I'm going to read something from Prabhupada to highlight the importance of what I said. So the first question is, and the reality check, the heading for the reality check is, am I harming or helping my Gurudev by being his disciple? Am I a help or a hindrance? So the first question, am I faithfully following the vows I made to him? So let's read from Srutta Kirti's wonderful book, What is a Devotee? This is story 112, entitled 80% Are Not Following, August 31st, 1974, ISKCON, Vrindavan, India. Srila Prabhupada arrived in Vrindavan on August 2nd, 1974. This was not the first time I had been with Srila Prabhupada during the course of an illness. But this illness in Vrindavan was much more frightening for his disciples. He had a very high fever, and having no appetite, ate almost nothing for over 2 weeks. His body was so weak that when he wanted to use the bathroom, I would help him out of bed and walk behind him with my arms under his armpits. News spread very quickly all over the world of his condition. Some devotees feared they would never see Srila Prabhupada again. He authorized a letter that was sent to all temples informing them to perform 24-hour kirtan to pray for his recovery. Prabhupada said, kirtan is what actually gives us life. For the last 2 weeks of August 1974, devotees all around the world performed kirtan vigils all day and night. The mood was very somber and intense. Srila Prabhupada one day sat up in his bed and looking at me said, this illness is because 80% of the leaders are not following the rules and regulations. He did not elaborate on his words, and I certainly didn't ask any questions at that time. First question. Second question. As his disciple, am I faithfully presenting and representing Prabhupada's teachings. Again, we'll read from Srila Kirti Prabhu's book. This time, we'll be reading story 84. This is May 14, 1973, in ISKCON, Los Angeles, California. One afternoon, one of his sannyasi disciples asked to see him. He entered the sunlit room and offered obeisances. I did not know what he wanted to speak to Srila Prabhupada about, but he did not seem to mind that I was with him. Therefore, I stayed. Srila Prabhupada looked up from behind his desk and smiled. Maharaj said, Prabhupada, I have to ask you a question. Did you say that World War III would begin on March 24th, 1974? Srila Prabhupada, with surprise in his face, immediately responded, I never said such a thing. Who has said this? I sat before Srila Prabhupada with a smile on my face. I had heard Prabhupada said so many times over the years. One could write volumes of misinformation of what he supposedly had said, or take out of context what he said to one person. My amusement was soon interrupted when the Maharaj responded to Prabhupada's inquiry, apparently Srila Kirti said it was you. Immediately Srila Prabhupada turned and looked at me with eyes wide open. Did you say this, Srila Kirti? No, Prabhupada. I quickly exclaimed my innocence. I have never said such a thing. I would never make up such a story. Srila Prabhupada shook his head in wonder, saying, just see. Then looking at both of us, he continued, they may say Prabhupada said this, and Prabhupada said that. But I haven't said anything. Unless you hear me say, I haven't said it. The short meeting ended there. I walked out of the room amazed at how rumors can take on a life of their own. There is nothing more dangerous than a Prabhupada said rumor. I could understand why he stressed the importance of reading his books. Numerous times he stressed that the answers to all our questions were in his books. I wanted to read you another one that's very interesting, and this one is from Prabhupada Nectar. Let me just find the page. This is from volume 5, that's number 49. Srila Prabhupada was very precise in his use of words and in his presentation of Krishna consciousness. Once one of his sannyasi disciples was giving a lecture in Prabhupada's presence, and he was explaining the absolute nature of the holy name. Krishna is in his name, the disciple said. Then Prabhupada interrupted him. Oh, he's in his name? Where in his name is he? His disciple fell silent. Krishna is not in his name, Prabhupada exclaimed. Krishna is his name. So it gives you we have such a responsibility to really understand what Prabhupada has given, to really preach what Prabhupada has given. Otherwise it becomes a Prabhupada saint and not a Prabhupada reality. Next one, next question for you to consider. Am I a conscious disciple? Am I conscious? There are a lot of difficulties if we're not. I'd like to read two stories, again from Prabhupada Nectar, about this. What is that? Asked Srila Prabhupada. He had just come onto the roof of the Mayapur building when he noticed a brass loiter. It was sitting next to a line of tulsi plants in pots. Srila Prabhupada seemed disturbed by the sight. Although to the group of devotees walking with him, the loiter and the tulsi plant seemed perfectly normal. Is something wrong, Prabhupada? A devotee asked. Look in the storeroom, Prabhupada replied, and see if the loiter is there. Someone ran into the storeroom, came out and said, no, Srila Prabhupada. Just see, said Srila Prabhupada. This is a great aparad. Devotees were amazed at Srila Prabhupada's immediate detective work. is surmising that someone had taken the storeroom loader and used it to water Tulsi plants. Conscious or unconscious. Next story. Sometimes Prabhupada circumambulated the Krishna Balaram temple, chanting japa as part of his morning walk. On one such occasion, he turned to the devotees accompanying him and said, "You are blind, but I am seeing." No one knew exactly what he meant. Was it a philosophical statement? After another circumambulation, Srila Prabhupada repeated, "You are blind, but I am seeing." This time, he pointed to light bulbs that were still burning outside the temple, although the sun was fully risen. You see the difference between conscious and unconscious. And Prabhupada, this is not an indication, he's worrying about light bulbs and lotus and things, it's not an indication of some kind of fetish. It's a Vedic maxim that if you waste natural resources, abuse natural resources, then you'll be deprived of them. So Prabhupada, and it's just a cultural point, it's not a personality trait in Prabhupada, it's a cultural point. You see, when people know the culture, they don't leave taps running, they don't leave fans on, they just don't do these things. Because they know, I've got a quota. We were talking about this last week, the Upanishad 1, we all have our quota. I have a quota to use the fan while I'm in the room and I'm under it. I don't have a quota to leave it on while I go somewhere else. But it's interesting, this idea of conscious or not conscious. Now let's take this question a little further. Am I a Krishna conscious disciple? Am I Krishna conscious? Again, we'll read from Prabhupada Netta. It's a wonderful compilation. Gumaraj is done. Very interesting. During a Sunday feast in Hyderabad, Prabhupada asked for a sample of the prasadam being served to the life members. When the prasadam was brought, Prabhupada said that it was terrible and he was infuriated. Prabhupada asked his disciple in charge about the cook. He explained that the man was hired, but was a Brahmin cook, and he even wore a thread. Prabhupada only became more angry and began to criticize the temple president. "But Prabhupada," he said, "he's chanting Hare Krishna." Prabhupada was so convinced that the so-called Brahmin chanter was bogus that he fired the cook on the spot. Now, interestingly enough, even though Prabhupada chastised them and fired the cook, they hired another cook. And Prabhupada again became very angry. Once again in Hyderabad, the devotees hired a cook. When Prabhupada found out about it, he again became very angry. He said that they had hired a common sweeper who had disguised himself as a Brahmana so that he could make some money, and that the food had been cooked in such bad consciousness that it had contaminated the innocent farmers who had eaten it. Then Prabhupada looked at his disciples and said, "Why didn't you ask me to cook? I would have cooked for them." And then all the disciples felt ashamed. And that was the last of hired cooks in Hyderabad. But this idea, you know, we have to be conscious. We have to be Krishna conscious. Because otherwise, we're as bad as that old lady.
Old lady.
Means the aunt who didn't correct her nephew. Okay, so something to think about. So let's read again what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says. And this time I want to read just what's in italics. It's very interesting because one of the primary tenets of Mahaprabhu's philosophy is Namruchi, Jivadoya, Vaishnava Seva. So these two, Namrutsi and Jivadoya, actually all three go together. Here we're choosing two of them to talk about, the relationship between attachment for Krishna and compassion for other living entities. Avasura, the personification of intolerance and purity, is the seventh obstacle. Due to a lack of compassion for the living entities, there is the possibility that one's attachment will gradually diminish, because compassion cannot remain separate from attachment. The basis of compassion for living entities and devotion to Krishna is the same, just like the two sides of a coin. Now, one of my favorite meditations on dealing with this aspect of Avasura is found in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on Canto 12, Chapter 11, Text 24. Very beautiful meditation. And he says, by practicing this meditation, we can actually achieve success in life.
Canto
12? 12, 11, 24, purport. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's being he's being quoted here. The earth, which is always visible to me, is the expansion of the lotus feet of my Lord, who is always to be meditated upon. All moving and non-moving living beings have taken shelter of the earth and are thus sheltered at the lotus feet of my Lord. For this reason, I should respect every living being and not envy anyone. In fact, all living entities constitute the Kasturba gem on my Lord's chest. Therefore, I should never envy or deride any living entity. So it's actually such a beautiful meditation, because he's bringing out the fact that, you know, this is not separatist mentality. We were reading earlier from Bhagavatam that, you know, someone who's in Tamagun, they're separatist. Someone who's actually in all three modes, actually, they're separatist. They don't actually realize the oneness of things, the unity of things. They're caught up in the diversity, the dualities. But here, Vishwanath is just reminding us that, hey, wait a minute.
As long as someone is in duality, there's no chance of not being one anymore.
Fact. Very good point. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur makes the same point. So, yeah, it's another good reason to become Krishna conscious. Okay. Are there any questions or comments on all this stuff?
Agasura felt he was justified in wanting to kill Krishna and the cowherd boys because Krishna killed his sister and his brother.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're under the illusion that something we do is justified. In
most of the time.
Yeah.
We work on that basis. And this is a very good reason to develop Shastra Shakshus. But instead of seeing things according to my limited understanding, what, you know, I think life's about. And actually, this is the most important reason for reading Prabhupada's books. Not that we become knowledgeable, but that we become a vesh, or we line up with Prabhupada's way of seeing things, Prabhupada's way of discriminating. Like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we've been reading Prabhupada's books for some time, with sincerity, then we start to see things the way Prabhupada does. You know, we start to discriminate like Prabhupada does. And it's a very safe position.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there are two ways that you can spell rationalize. It can be rationalized, you know, rationalize something the way we usually use it, but it can also be cut rational lies.
Oh.
And that's actually what it's about.
Yeah.
That's actually what it's about. So we can do both ways. And yeah, a good idea to like take our parameters from the Shastra, what the Acharya said, and not from our tiny, puny little understanding of things. Mm-hmm. You know, why take an ant's view when you can take a swan's view? You want to say something, Brad?
That same things he was asking. I think 2 days ago, Radhan and Marathi explained in his class. You went for his classes?
No.
He said that he was also speaking about envy and like, and he told that story how Mantara was preaching to
Kaikeyi.
And she was even Ram's mother, and she had love for Ram, but then by her association, she became also envious. And he said that the person who is envious, they don't know. Like he said, Mantara, she was completely convinced that how she sees Ram, he's like that. That he will become king, uh-huh. And then he will make Bharat suffer, and she will become this. Like he said, it like we become so convinced by our own bad qualities that we just think we are right, and reality is like that. But actually, we are completely wrong. But we don't know that we are only envious.
So we begin our first operation. Dr. Krishnachandra is here. We'll begin first by discussing Srila Prabhupada's Krishna book presentation of this leela. Anybody like to say something about that?
Well, I really like the point of all the boys being dependent on Krishna. The mood is like Avasharakshabe Krishna. When they're walking inside the mouth, they're like, okay, even if he swallows, Krishna's there to protect us. So that's so sweet. Ah, that mood of dependence.
Wonderful, yeah. Anything else?
I like that how when it is sometimes Krishna is sometimes changing his role. Like first he gets bewildered and he thinks. Like I think Prabhupada even mentioned Krishna is the super soul in everyone's heart, but then he thinks that what he didn't want the boys to go in, but they went in, and then he was thinking, oh no, what to do now? And then he makes his plan, and then again he's in control. He just goes inside and kills the snake.
Yeah. Anything else?
It was interesting to see that it's mentioned that Agasur's position was greater than that of a yogi. Because Krishna personally entered in his body.
So here's one person trying to kill Krishna.
But sorry. That made me think of like what you're always explaining, that the main thing is affection, because only the devotees, they can, whatever Krishna is, like sometimes he behaves like this, sometimes like this. You never know next moment, like what his plan will be. But the devotees are always ready. Like they go, whatever he likes, somehow they can understand and they
flow with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they work by heart, not by intelligence or mind. It's a great asset. We have to develop that. I was attracted by the same thing as Sitarani. And a really interesting meditation spun off from that, and that is that this dependence on Krishna just walking into the demon's mouth, oh, Krishna, take care.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that actually this is the mood of our preachers, and they take so many risks, mm-hmm. and they do it with full confidence in Krishna. And it's not like they even think about it. They're so well versed in experiencing Krishna's protection. It's just a given that Krishna will protect me. And we saw it particularly with Hare Krishnami, what he went through in opening up Russia. So many of the men that went in there. Tamar Krishna Maharaj in China. I mean, what went on in those places is amazing. And I wanted to share a personal story with this because it was such an amazing experience. When I was in Mayapur, I used to always, when it was Janava Mata's appearance day, I'd make a point either to go to Ambika Kalna, her birthplace where she grew up, or I'd go to Ekachakra. But one year, you know, just worked out according to my preaching show that I was going to be in Calcutta. So I was thinking, well, if I have to be in Calcutta, I have to do something very special. And I had a couple of weeks to prepare. So I was thinking and thinking and praying and praying, and then I got this idea. Chalamamada was even more merciful than Nityananda. So I'm going to attract her mercy. I have to really do something special. So I got some people in Calcutta that I was preaching to. I got them to check, who were Hindi speaking. I got them to check out where the abattoirs were.
What?
Where the slaughterhouses were.
Hmm.
Where they slaughtered cows. And if any of them were owned by Muslims and only hired Muslims. And then I found one, it was a small, it was on the outskirts of Calcutta. It was a small place, only about 300 people working there. And then I made inquiries about getting Prabhupada's small books on Urdu. So we got a few hundred copies of the Urdu book and we set off. And we went there unannounced and managed to make our friends with the guy who ran the place. And always works, prasadam always works. And then we walked into this most horrendous sight. I felt like I walked into a hellish planet. There's all these carcasses of cows. They were cleaning them up ready for sale as meat. And everywhere was blood and everywhere was the intestine. And it was such an incredible thing. But I felt like I was in some kind of bubble. And I was just smiling to all these people and handing out books to people. I wasn't charging them. I just wanted to get those books out. And I was handing them to them, and they were taking them with blood-stained hands. They were working with blood all day. And when I left that place, I won't go into the gory details, but when I left that place, I was covered with blood, cow blood. But I was in ecstasy. And then, you know, I went back and I said, you know, devotees noticed where I was staying. They noticed, you know, how come, you know, you're clumping. I said, I just did a bit of distribution in effect. They were horrified. And then I got back to my managerial and spiritual authorities. They were horrified. You know what could have happened? I mean, it's ridiculous. It's so dangerous that you did that. But I didn't even think it. I didn't even think twice about doing it. Because, you know, when I was in Australia, I was distributing up and down the east coast of Australia on my own all the time. That included horror highways, so many things. You know, I'd just grown used to the fact that whatever I did, Krishna would protect me. And he did. But then when I read this in Agasura, I thought, it's not even that, you know, they say, okay, it's a risk, but we'll do it. You don't even think it's a risk. Krishna's there, it's not a risk. You know. And it was, the whole thing expanded in my mind from this little statement of the boy is going to Agasura's mouth, you know. But I thought, wow, you know, everyone was so disturbed. It's such a dangerous thing to go. You're all Muslims, you know, and you're a white woman walking in this, you know, and it's a slaughterhouse, and rah. really didn't see it as a problem.
It's like the ecstasy of the service. Just surpassed any fear that you may have had, or not that you had it, but that's why it's like you didn't even think about that.
I didn't even think about it. It was just,
it's just like the compassion to find the most.
I mean, I'm the kind of person, I can't stand the sight of blood.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I was a young kid, my first thing, you know, first I wanted to be a nun, then I saw through it, then I wanted to be a vet, because I'd be helping animals. So my mother, she was a very intelligent woman. She took me in, she arranged for me to see an operation on a dog, and I fainted. I couldn't stand the sight of blood. But, you know, so I don't have a strong, you know, I don't have strong resistance to these kind of things. But I don't know, I just got into some kind of mood. And all I could see was these men that were going to hell.
Right.
And they lived blood. They were just constant, all over blood. And, you know, when they put that bloodied hand out to me, all I wanted to do was put a book in it.
Right.
But, you know, but that's a little bit that I got from that. That wonderful little insight Prabhupada gives us in Krishna book.
Are the slaughterhouses at Hindus?
What's that?
The other slaughterhouses had Hindus.
A lot of them are run by Hindus.
They slaughter cows for Durga or what?
No, they slaughter cows also.
Yeah, actually the biggest beef exporter is from India. and he's a Hindu in the world.
Wow. Trouble with materialistic religion. Things don't add up. Okay, let's read from Bhagavad-Samhita. Srinarad said, once as Krishna was herding the calves along with the other boys near the beautiful Yamuna and thus enjoying the pastimes of childhood, a great demon named Agasura came there. His body was 2 miles long and his mouth was wide open. From afar, the boys saw the demon. His body was like a great mountain. Approaching and clapping their hands, they entered his mouth along with their calves. To protect them, Krishna entered the mouth along with the boys. When the demon in the form of a snake had swallowed the boys and calves, the demons cried out, "Alas!" And the demons became happy. Krishna then expanded his universal form inside Agasura's stomach. The snake's movements stopped, and his life breath broke through his skull and left. Then Krishna and the boys and calves left his mouth. With a glance, Krishna brought the boys and calves back to life. Then a light that was like a lightning flash left the demon's body and entered Krishna, who was as dark as a monsoon cloud. The demigod showered flowers. After hearing the sage's words, the king of Mathila said, "Who was this demon in his previous birth that he was able to enter Lord Krishna? Simply by hating him, this demon quickly obtained the Lord." Srinarad said, "O king, he was Sankachuta's son, and his name was Aga. He was young, strong, and very handsome. He was like another Kamadev. When he saw the disfigured sage Astavakra Muni walking by the Malaya hills, Aga laughed and said, 'Oho, who is this ugly person?' The sage cursed the demon Aga, saying, 'O wicked-hearted one, you become a snake, and you will be the ugliest snake on earth.'" Seeing that the demon, his pride and arrogance now gone, had fallen at his feet, the sage became pleased with him and gave him a benediction. Astavakra said, "Sri Krishna, who is more handsome than many millions of Kamadevs, will enter your stomach. Then you will be freed from having a snake's form." Srinarad said, "By Astavakra's curse, Agasura became a snake, and by Astavakra's blessing, he attained liberation even the demigods cannot hope to achieve." By hearing how in only a few days Krishna had been rescued from Vatsasura, Bakasura's beak, and now Agasura, Yashoda became filled with fear. Calling together Kalavati, Rohini, the most important gopis and gopis, the Gopa king, Bishabanu, Vajas king, Nanda, the nine Upanandas, the Nandas, the Bishabanus, and the various leaders of Braj, Yashoda spoke to them. She said, "What shall I do? Where shall I go? How can I be happy? Moment after moment, many calamities are falling on my son. We left Mahavan and came to Vrindavan. If we leave Vrindavan, what safe country, free of fearful calamities, can we go to? Please tell me. When he plays, my restless boy goes far away. All the boys are restless. I'm not the only one to say that. Powerful and sharp-beaked Bakasura swallowed my boy. Somehow he was rescued. Another day, Agasura swallowed my boy and all the other boys. When he tried to kill my boy, Vatsasura was himself killed by his own fate. Now I will not allow my boy to go outside to care for the calves." The calves. He's still a baby. He's only 3. Srinarad said, glancing at Yashoda, she spoke these words and wept. Nanda, who was the best of pious and who understood the true meaning of religion, spoke to her. He comforted her by repeating the words of Garga Muni. Nanda Maharaj said, "Oh Yashoda, you have completely forgotten Garga Muni's words. The words of the Brahmanas are always true. They are never untrue. Therefore, charity should be given. That will dispel all calamities. There has never been, nor will there ever be, a source of good fortune better than giving charity." Srinarad said, "O king, on behalf of her boy and Balaram, Yashoda then gave to the Brahmanas great wealth 7 kinds of precious jewels, and even her own ornaments. Nanda gave in charity 10,000 bulls, 100,000 beautiful cows, and huge piles and piles of grain. So very sweet. They're thinking, what's happening? And then they remember the sage's words. They have faith in that. And so they just, then maybe what we should do is just follow the Vedic maximum, time of calamity, we give charity, mm-hmm. and they get on with life. Mm-hmm. Would you like to read Kalimagasura from Ananda Vrindavan Chai?
Yes. The cowherd boys joked with one another, "Oh, brothers, let us see who can run fastest, Krishna or us." Krishna kept the lead as they raced a short distance. They stopped abruptly, however, upon noticing a peculiar sight. It was a demon, the younger brother of Putana and Bakasur, whom Krishna had recently vanquished. Burning with anger and lamentation, the demon had come to Vrindavan to avenge the loss of his relatives. The nasty, vicious demon assumed the form of a gigantic, envious python with a huge mouth extending from the surface of the earth to the heavenly planets. At every moment, his hideous body continued to expand. His vast gaping mouth seemed to swallow the whole creation, along with all its moving and non-moving living entities. Brahma and all the demigods shook in fright at this embodiment of sin, who was appropriately named Agasur. Awestruck and bewildered by what they saw, the cowherd boy said, "Oh, look! What is this strange mountain cave? Just examine closely and try to figure it out. Who on earth will not be curious upon seeing this unusual cave? From long neglect, the cave looks like the deep mouth of a huge snake. The twin mountain peaks appear like two rows of teeth. The two vines dangling in the breeze by the opening of that cave seem to be the frightening forked tongue of a snake. The red oxide dust blowing out of the mouth of the cave, indicating a mine of minerals, seems like his fiery poisonous breath mixed with reddish gold sparks. Just smelling that smoke, which appears to be the snake's breath, gives one a severe headache. The vines and creepers surrounding the cave, which look like hands waving us into it, appear like the ugly veins and arteries around the snake's gaping mouth. The two dazzling ruby boulders resting just above the mountain cave appear like the captivating eyes of the snake waiting to mesmerize anyone who glances at them. The strong wind coming from the cave, which shakes the trees in the forest, resembles the exhalation of a big serpent. The smoking glow of the mountain seems like the discoloration of the snake's body caused by his poison-filled breath. The large cave looks like the massive mouth of the snake. Who amongst us is not overwhelmed with fear upon seeing this mysterious creature?" Though disturbed with dread and doubt, the cowherd boys decided to enter the mouth of the cave. One boy said, "Oh, brothers, if it is a demon, Krishna will easily kill him and protect us." All the gopas had firm faith in Krishna. Gazing at the beautiful smiling face of Krishna, they laughed and clapped their hands while walking towards the python. Seeing that they intended to enter the snake demon, Krishna, the prince of Vrindavan, tried to stop his friends by shouting in a sweet voice that spread through the creation. "Hey boys, stop! 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 Do not go inside. It is not a mountain cave, it is a snake." But it was too late. They did not hear Krishna's words of warning because they had already fallen unconscious from inhaling the poisonous vapors within the viper's throats. Cool. Feeling like he had lost some most precious jewels, Krishna cried piteously. He only thought how to kill the demon and save his devotees. Then Krishna, fully confident of his unlimited abilities, nonchalantly walked into the demon's mouth. Seeing this, the demigods wailed in anguish, "Alas! Alas!" But Kansa and other demoniac friends of Agasur rejoiced by cheering, "Ha! Ha! Ha!" Upon hearing the distressed crying of the demigods, Krishna, the master of all mystic yogis, decided to finish the asura. The heart of the snake shook in fear of his imminent destruction. Although adept in mystic illusions, the demon's vast intelligence had now become bewildered by his false ego. He tried desperately to close his mouth, but he could not. Because of Krishna's superior mystic power, the snake lost all control over his movements and just sat with his mouth stuck open. The snake felt Krishna to be a hot fiery spark burning his throat. A second later, Krishna expanded himself within the throat of the snake until the demon's body exploded like an overripe green melon. Krishna's transcendental body contains unlimited opulences of beauty and perfect action. His elegance rivals the rising moon, and his compassion excels the comfort of soothing moonshine. After killing that ugly demon, Krishna revived his friends with a pleasant stream of nectar emanating from his beautiful transcendental form. Then he came out of the demon's mouth with the cowherd boys and calves. As Krishna left the mouth of the demon, he appeared like the sun rising from behind a mountain. Wearing an attractive forest garland hanging to his knees, Krishna looked as gorgeous as a fresh blue rain cloud. At that time, everyone saw the spirit soul of the demon, more brilliant than hundreds of suns and moons, merged in the body of Krishna. Who can describe the merciful nature of the Lord? First, the demon let Krishna enter his belly, and then Krishna allowed him to enter his body. Appreciating the wonderful glories of the Lord Brahma, Brahma, Shiva, and other demigods offered prayers which sanctified the word as they echoed throughout the universe. Various drums, such as kettle drums and dudumbis, and other instruments reverberated in all directions. The wives of the Gandharvas and Vidyadhars sang joyously in high-pitched voices, as the wives of the Siddhas beat Midrangas. Urvashi and other heavenly nymphs danced ecstatically. The best of the Kinnaras sang sweet melodies. Becoming deaf to all other vibrations, the celestial denizens, submerged in the sound waves of that ocean of jubilation, intoxicated with bliss, they showered flowers from Nandankanan on Krishna. What more can be said? The beat of Shiva's drum predominated everywhere. In great euphoria, Lord Shiva danced so widely that he cracked the pot-like covering of the universe. As he danced, the crescent moon on his head poured a stream of nectar. When that nectar touched the skulls of Shiva's necklace, the skulls assumed bodies and danced joyfully with great skill. Astonished by the scene, the demigods exploded with uproarious laughter. The cowherd boys appeared like they had just left the jaws of death. They felt completely relieved and happy to see the tender lotus face of the peaceful prince of Raj, which looked more attractive than the rising sun. The transcendental deeds of the Lord completely eclipsed the glories of the sun. One after another, the boys embraced Krishna while talking excitedly. One boy said, "O Krishna, while we played, the terrible demon devoured us and knocked us out with a burning poison. How did you bring us back to life?" Krishna replied, "I am the perfect antidote to neutralize poison and also kill the poison giver. If a man smells this medicine, he will become joyful and relish it like the taste of honey. Even the dead will come back to life and enjoy sweet rasa if they smell this medicine." Krishna's witty remarks increased the cowherd boy's loving friendship for him. Then the cowherd boys, the Lord's eternal associates, enthusiastically embraced each other. Swelling with pride for his beloved friend Krishna, one boy said to the other boys, "I told you before that Krishna would finish this demon, just as he previously killed Bakasur."
I wanted to just share something with you from Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. I just remembered it. It's very sweet. He does many things, so we don't have a lot of time, so I won't read all of it to you, but just a little bit to give you an idea. One thing he does is he tells us what Agasura is thinking. He says, "This person," this is Agasura thinking, "this person has killed my older sister Putana and my brother. On their behalf, therefore, I will kill Krishna as a pindar offering along with his followers. If Krishna and the other boys become the sacrificial offering through the pretas for my brother and sister, Nanda and the other inhabitants of Braj will automatically die. If life has left the body, need we worry any more about the bodies? Living entities live through their children. Therefore, if their beloved child Krishna dies, then Nanda, Yashoda and the rest of the Brajavasis will automatically die without us having to kill them." quite a nasty fellow. This is what he was thinking. And then he actually goes on for quite a lot about the mood of the boys. And it's very, very sweet. But I'll just read you a little pinch of it for today. A few of the boys thought that Agasura was a big snake, so they started to run away upon seeing it. Other boys, however, thought that Agasura was simply a wonderful scenic spot of Vrindavan. They comforted their fearful friend, saying, "Oh, fools, a snake can never be this big. It's just some statue fashioned by Krishna, so that we can appreciate the splendor of Vrindavan even more." Krishna made it look like a huge snake with a big gaping mouth. In this way, the cowboys thought the Lord's creation was something just like the gaping mouth of a servant, made just for pastimes. And then he goes on to say so many, many more things, but just to give you a little bit of an insight.
And Prabhupada mentions that, you know.
Yeah, he takes a lot from Vishwanath.
Yeah, and he mentions that the body was there and they were using it for playing for like...
They're so perfectly naive.
Oh, to be so naive. Yeah. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Okay, so let's read from Gopal Champu, another dimension on the same river. Very beautiful. One time, waking up very early in the morning, the brother of Balaram developed a strong desire. "Today, we should have our morning meal in the forest." Finishing his morning duties, he asked his mother to allow this. Pleasing his mother by his actions, he went out with her permission, and with the sound of his buffalo horn, woke up his friends. Going quickly and sitting at the crossroads and waiting for his friends for a few moments, he looked around. When Krishna started for the forest, a million horns and flutes resounded, and a million calves cried out, mixed with the boys shouting. Thus Krishna playfully made Balaram's heart and the whole world tremble. Though the boys were beautiful because of the jewels as they entered the forest, they ornamented their bodies with fruits and buds from the trees and used a multitude of glass beads brought in packets from their houses after much pleading with their mothers. Absorbed in playing, they did not consider that one thing was better than another. Placing the food packets on tree branches, they became absorbed in moving here and there as they played, while Krishna glanced about. They stole each other's sticks, flutes, and lunches. Considering it their own, they would throw the item far away. Then they would bring it back and give it to the rightful owner. They all engaged in suitable play by the quick movements of Krishna's brow at every second, and they knew nothing else. By playing the flute, some boys indicated that they would hide an object. Others blew their horns and made Krishna laugh. Others, considering the horns to have a vulgar sound, rejected those sounds and made sounds like bees and cuckoos. Speed is an object of praise for cowherds, whereas singing is the occupation of sannyasis. And so some boys, thinking in this way, swiftly ran after the shadows of the birds. Thinking they were superior because of being able to imitate various birds, some boys walked among the swans, cranes, and peacocks. Others, in order to show their knowledge of making bamboo puppets, joyfully moved among the branches with the monkeys. All the youngest boys were engaged in satisfying Krishna. Some boys went to the waterfalls and crossed over the river, jumping with the frogs. And when they saw their own reflections in the water, they laughed. Laughing and playing, they satisfied Krishna. He sent boys to curse the echoes and imitate the reflections in the water, and he obtained joy from this. And when Krishna desired another type of play, the boys, skillful at all arts, diversified the antics. But then, the younger brother of Bakara and Bhutana, Agasura, appeared on their path, like a black cloud suddenly appearing in the sky. He'd been praised by Kamsa, "Oh, my great assistant! Give up disappointment and listen. You do not know that by not staying awake and sleeping all the time, dear Python, a great problem has arisen. For this reason I have woken you up." Aga said, "O Lord of the universe, please give me your order." Beginning from the voice in the sky on Devaki's wedding day, Kansa told the whole story by praising himself. My assistant, Sashupatthana, full of poison, found novel ways of deception, but all their endeavors met with failure. Thus you, my dear Agasura, are my only hope. Please use your ability to devour everything. Aga quickly spread himself in front of Krishna's friends and assumed the form of a long snake. He remained fixed there. Jokingly, the boys describe him as a huge snake. In front of us is a huge snake emitting poison. He's lying awake. If he devours us, certainly he will die, just like Bhaka. Saying this and looking at Krishna's face, clapping their hands while frolicking and laughing, they enter the mouth of the Aga, just like a cave of a mountain. The calves, glowing with brilliance, followed the boys. Though Krishna did not want them to do so, he did not get the opportunity to prevent them. He was astonished and then became remorseful. But then, just as the sun enters a dense fog, he followed the boys and calves into the demon's mouth. The demons and devatas situated nearby and far off repeatedly began crying out, "Oh! Oh!" in joy and sorrow, not knowing the powers of Krishna. Making the same sound, the two groups expressed different sentiments, that of victory and that of fear. Aga acted like Bhagasura, but with the assistance of Yogamaya, full of the power of Nanda's austerities. Krishna, endowed with unlimited power, expanded in the throat of Aga, just as his arm expanded on entering the throat of Keshi. After a few moments, the demon's breathing stopped. Then he lost consciousness. Then his head split open and his life air departed. The soul, having associated with Krishna and becoming purified, waited outside in order to attain an eternally fresh body. Having killed the demon from our inside, Krishna revived the cows and boys with his sweet glance. As the moon emerges from the mouth of Rahu, he emerged from Aga's mouth by the path that he'd entered. When they all emerged from the demon, like the Ganga flowing from the Himalayas, the demon's effulgence merged into the effulgence coming from Krishna's body. All people saw that the light merging into Krishna's body was just like a spark merging into the light of the sun. At that time, the devatas, headed by Brahma, standing in front of Krishna, played music and recited prayers, showered flowers from the trees of heaven, worshipped Krishna, and mocked Aga. So then the boys, they take their lunch packets. They kept them in the trees while all of this was going on to protect their lunch. Then the boys began to move about restlessly. They arrived at a forest with a fragrant lake full of water in the middle. A huge area in the distance became suddenly smaller. Arriving there, lotus-eyed Krishna, with a smile on his face, revealed his intentions. "Oh, friends, look, there's a lake like a pure mind. The beauty of the lotuses in the pond is revealed by the touch of the sunlight. The beauty increases by the bees. The forest and lake nourish each other's qualities continually. The forest increases with the fragrance of hundreds of flowers, and the lake increases with very sweet tastes. The bank, whose earth is covered by flowers, fruit and frost, and dover grass, shines with soft piles of sand. It stands at the end of the pure water. It is the place for animals to rest, and a dwelling place for millions of trees. I think we should take our lunch here, since we're already hungry because the time is very late. Here the calves may drink water and go silly here and there and eat." Placing the food on level ground, the friends first bathed in the lake and then gathered together. Having Krishna in the center, the boys forgot all suffering. As the chakora bird desires to drink the nectar coming from the moon, the boys just stood there, drinking in Krishna's beauty. Eager to protect the calves, Krishna with great care distributed the food to his friends, and the forest then took on a fresh new beauty. For now, Vrindavan was free from demons. Such a beautiful presentation of this Leela.